You're listening to Framework, where we dig into the research, planning, and building that goes into bringing products to market. I'm Rob Hayes.
And I'm Tom Creighton. And today we're talking with Emily Lonetto, the head of growth at Voiceflow, a collaborative design and prototyping tool for voice user experiences on platforms like Alexa and Google Home. Emily, can you give us a short intro to yourself and the marketplace you just launched for Voiceflow?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you guys mentioned, I'm the head of growth at Voiceflow. So my job is really to try to figure out how can we get more designers, developers, and creators to use a platform like ours to discover what voice design and voice development looks like, and also make it easier for them to launch on platforms like Alexa and Google without any code. Yeah, and the marketplace is one of the key elements that we're trying to experiment with right now, because given the fact that the voice industry is quite new, we want to make it easier for people to not only build using our tool, but also share what they're working on, get inspired, and hopefully improve discoverability in a section that hasn't really been indexed that well just yet.
Awesome. So to set the context for our discussion about the marketplace, you're the head of growth at Voiceflow, but is there a blurry line between what growth is and what product is? How on your team are you distinguishing between what is a growth problem to solve versus a product problem to solve?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that growth and product are one of those weird little shifting lines, no matter what type of company that you're in. For Voiceflow specifically, we're a product-led org. So what that really means is that we're not relying on sales, at least just yet, to really grow what our user base looks like. And our CS org isn't really mature where we're trying to figure out how we can use people to help solve activation or retention. So really what my growth team's focused on and kind of what I'm focused on differently than product is, instead of building what our core feature map would look like, is how can we launch different experiments or different features that help improve people's understanding of the product, people's activation, or in this case, people's inspiration for why they would want to use something like Voiceflow in the first place, given that we're solving a problem that may not be that big of a problem for that many people just yet.
So that's definitely some ways that I think you can identify the kind of problems that a growth team should solve. How do you quantify what problems are worth actually solving or investing in?
So I think it's a really collaborative effort with growth and product. So I work really, really closely with Mike, who runs product at Voiceflow right now, where he's spending his time really diving into the weeds of what are the necessary core features that we need in order to be successful to deliver the product experience that we need. And where I'll be able to kind of dive in deeper is try to talk and do more user interviews on what made the people that came onto the platform without our help successful? What were the issues or the fallbacks that they kind of hit? And is this something that is a core feature problem, or is this maybe more of an education problem? Is there something that we can bring outside of the product or earlier on in onboarding that can make that step a little bit easier for them? So kind of the main thing that at least I'm looking for being an early venture is really trying to understand what is the gap in education around our product, so we can find ways to automate that, as well as put that into our onboarding or strategically later on in the product.
So it sounds like the kind of distinction is around what is core feature and functionality versus what is the constellation of functionality around that that supports it, that drives it, that makes it more usable, helps acquire more people and drive them to that core function. How do you determine what is core functionality versus what's in that kind of constellation of supporting functions that you focus on?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the constellation app or constellation build as a theory is really interesting. The way that I kind of try to break that down with my team and when I talk with the product team back at Voiceflow is we really like to think about what are the actions that users need to take throughout their journey and what is the natural frequency of those actions. So for instance, with Voiceflow, a core thing that we really need people to be able to understand is they have to drag certain blocks over. That's going to happen multiple frequencies each time that they want to build something because we're a flow visual builder. But the core thing that that's going towards is we need them to actually be able to click play for the first time and see what they've been working on and actually feel what that voice experience could simulate. So one of the things that we realized there is that that kind of mini moment that isn't quite at the step where it's publishing the actual app to Alexa or Google, but is really the first time that they experience that, wow, this is something that works. This is something that's different than building a website or building a graphic interface. And now focusing in on that experience and how can we bring that either faster in their first day within the product, or how can we bring that outside of the product so that people can understand what that feels like and perhaps use this as a motivation to actually sign up in the first place. So really what you're trying to do is break down what are some of these great and easy actions that are repeatable and are easy to understand, and how can you either make them more succinct and faster to understand in the product, or experiment with maybe you can bring them outside, make them a Constellation app, and perhaps use this as a lead generation tool that lives outside of the core.
So then you're looking at these actions, kind of the key inflection points within your app user experience. And then that becomes the problem to focus on. And you just kind of take a number of runs at that, or apply a number of experiments to that. And the marketplace being one of those experiments to get people to that aha moment, the position where they, or the point in the experience where they can hit play.
Absolutely. So basically the way that you always think about these Constellation apps is the truth is it's not super easy to figure out what all of them are, and you can just list them off and kind of put them in a very logical roadmap, because sometimes you really don't know. Like a lot of cases, Constellation apps are really easy actions that are repeatable. So that's a good way of just kind of starting to think about what might be or have potential for being a Constellation. But I would say, to kind of your point on why you want to experiment around this, or why this is an interesting growth opportunity, is really to also just test like what are those core features that may even be like holding people back from trying your product in the first place, or might, or you see as being maybe a point of resistance. Is there a way that you can ease that before they get into the product, so when it comes to the actual core experience, it's not an issue? Or are there ways in this case that we don't necessarily know what people want to share with what they've created right now? Because when you look at any other creator tool, let it be Sketch, or even when someone builds something via code and publishes on GitHub, a lot of that kind of secondary function is sharing that, being able to show someone your work, be proud of that, or even go and search through things like Dribbble to get inspiration to then go and build. So really what we were trying to focus in on from this growth side using our marketplace is that we know that we want to help people create things easier and faster using voice, but we don't necessarily know what is sticky enough that they want to share that. What are things that we can put out there so that other people can think more creatively about what they might want to build if they're just not at that point yet? And more to that point as well is maybe they don't want to just showcase their work. Maybe they want to copy what they see out there, and they want templates, or maybe they want plugins or other forms of sharing as well.
That's super cool. I'd love to dig a bit deeper on that, specifically that you mentioned the idea of sharing out and also pushing the educational boundaries of the app sort of beyond the app itself. For instance, I think something that we've noted is that Voiceful actually has a really active Facebook community. How much do those kind of external communities of users and sharing get folded back into the work that you're doing?
Honestly, with Voiceflow, it is so integral. Our community is the core of so much of our decision making, of our instant feedback loops in a lot of cases, and even just like even right now, I'm recording this outside of Toronto, which is where our HQ is. I'm in San Francisco, and I was just able to just pop up in that group and ask if anyone's around, if they want to grab a coffee and like talk and actually get to know our team. So one of the things that like we really, really focus in on, especially with our community, is really trying to keep them engaged, even separate out what do they want from the team versus the product, because that's really core in a lot of cases with communities, and continue to use them as opportunities to get to know what are they building, how can we inform our product roadmap for both hobbyists but also pro users, and really continue to use them to even figure out like what else are they looking for outside of our core functionality? So it's a really core aspect, especially for the growth team, because it's such a huge builder for our brand, but also where can we expand in the future?
Mm-hmm. How do you avoid, I guess, focusing over much on the issues that like really, really vocal and passionate users are raising in that kind of context?
So I think what's really interesting about a community is there's so much to it that actually comes and falls on the team in terms of curation, in terms of how are you setting up this community and the standards that are within that. But I think a lot of people make mistakes when it comes to launching communities where they'll either make it so product feedback heavy that you accidentally open up this like black hole of people commenting or sub-commenting on bugs. Yeah. Or you go the other way, which I've seen happen so many times, where a company raises a bunch of money, they decide that they want to launch a community because it's cool and it's a thing. And they end up attracting a bunch of transactional motivated users who will totally drop you the second that you're not giving them a really valuable reward for, let's say, referring people or things like that. We've tried really, really hard to make sure that we are focused in on people who are genuinely excited about the space, who are excited to share creations that they're working on. They want to test out other people's projects that are there. We do occasionally seed questions that are more like, what is like the new Amazon Alexa hardware device that you're most excited for? To kind of figure out like loosely, what should we be thinking about from a build side? Or yeah. We'll think about more pointed, like what are the best things about your voice flow experience, or what was your first app versus the one that you're at right now? And this is an easier way to just curate what that conversation looks like, so you don't end up just overemphasizing on exact product feedback, because that sometimes can be difficult to balance. And to kind of bring it back to your original bit on how do you avoid focusing too much on that is, again, like really trying to separate that from just trying to see what happens in the echo chamber in a group versus like the second someone posts something that seems to be a product issue or a piece of feedback, hop on the phone with them, make sure it goes through a process, make sure that it goes into a database and we can figure out where it can fall within a sprint. So in that way, we're not too reactionary. We're trying to see where is most of the feedback coming and does it align with certain features that are on that map.
Using it for directional feedback, identifying patterns, but not as like explicit build orders for the development team.
Yeah, and I think that's really difficult, and there's a fine line with that, especially when you start to build personal relationships with people in your community. But at the same time, it is extremely important to let them feel like they have that, and they also have that opportunity to be heard. So the response on that is actually the most important thing. Not necessarily the speed of you going and actually enacting on the exact things that they've asked for.
So for the marketplace itself, you know, did this originate as feedback that you heard from the community where it was kind of hard to get up and running and getting to that point of being able to press play? Or is this something that you've kind of discovered internally looking at quantitative metrics or just kind of is more of an intuition driven problem that you know you need to solve?
So I think with this case, it was a bunch of different things. We had seen a lot of people using the group and even on Twitter trying to find people to help them build things. So kind of more of like an Upwork style environment. We saw people who were organically sharing the things that they were building in our group, but Facebook is an awesome place to kind of have collaborative conversation, but isn't necessarily great for indexing that and mm-hmm. making it easier to find time and time again. And then we also saw a lot of people just kind of organically talking about things that they would like to see and they wanted to see other things that people were working on. They didn't really know where to start. We started to like pull a lot of people when they first signed up on like what gets you excited about it. And we saw a lot of even from user behavior in the sessions that they had where hobbyists would sign up in the hordes, but not a lot of them would get to the point where they'd actually publish something because they didn't have a task or goal specifically set in the same way that someone who does this for their job does. So there's kind of like a lot of that. Plus you look into the industry as a whole And I think podcasting actually has fallen into this a little bit, where it's really difficult to kind of search through a lot of these voice files and see kind of what can you pull if you're just looking for small snippets, in the same way that you can with a design on Dribbble or even like a snippet of code or a plugin. So we really just wanted to take a look at the industry. How can we present an easier way for people to find these forms of inspiration and share what they're working on, potentially connect with people, and just kind of start with that just open goal in mind, make it easy for them to share. And that's kind of where this whole thing started. And obviously there's a lot of other things that we'd like to test moving forward on that.
With growth, is there the same mentality as in product of really validating the experiments that you're running before sinking a lot of resources into them?
Oh, absolutely. Such a core aspect of growth is actually trying to really dial back and pull yourself away from what could this look like when it's fully built, and dial it back one more time again and again until you get to probably the scrappiest version of it that you could possibly get. And in a lot of cases where I actually think growth is, pardon me on this one, but is even harder than product to validate sometimes is because, I know, right? For shame.
This podcast is over.
Is that a lot of times you got to do this without any dev, without any dev resources, without any code. A lot of times you're the one who actually has to kind of fake it in a lot of cases. So especially even with this marketplace, like we knew that we wanted to make it easy for people to share it. The most bare bones version of it is we could seed it in the Facebook group and we could be like, oh, guys, post what you've built this week and just hope that people do that if theoretically that was our only goal. But in order to really kind of test it on its own, I knew what I would want it to look like if I were to steal a dev away. But we all know how difficult that is when you have a whole company that you really need to support. But instead, we actually decided to start this project itself actually on Airtable, which fundamentally still handled all the input data that people would put in. So actually submitting and then just showcasing what was there with us just being able to approve whether or not it was something that we wanted to show. So it was able to actually do the core functionality of what a marketplace would do and see if people would actually submit to something that wasn't on Facebook and really prove that out. And then we just kind of let it live to see would it organically keep getting those submissions if we weren't pushing it too much. If we just reminded people that the link existed. And that was kind of our first test of validation on whether or not we should even go further with it, period.
Mm-hmm. And you touch on the resource considerations that you have when you're planning out these experiments. And this is something we've talked about literally since we've known each other is, you know, growth often operates with, you know, few product development resources, if any, or they're borrowing from other teams. And like, I guess you could have full-blown product development resources on your team, but like, is it actually better to be limited in that sense? Does that actually enhance the outcome of what you do or force constraints on your work that actually help you improve kind of what the output is?
I think part of me, I'm torn on this question. Part of me is always like, okay, I would like to have as many resources as people will give me. But I think the added constraint and the added element of having to really push your boundaries on being like an expert internal negotiator, an expert internal motivator, where you're often trying to convince people to deviate off of something, or you need to get people so excited about trying out this new experiment that may be a little weird, that may not be something that will have like immediate feedback on or even immediate impact. And it really forces someone in that position to get really, really good at asking for exactly what they need and not what they want. And I think this is something that like I still struggle with. I think a lot of people do, because you will take whatever people will give you. But I think that being put in a position where you are resource constrained and often are kind of negotiating or trying to go against the status quo really also attracts a different type of person and a different type of resource. Let's say if an engineer comes onto that team. And I think I've been seeing more and more of that as I've jumped from different companies and have been tackling similar growth problems across the board.
So you've mentioned that the V1 of this marketplace was built on Airtable, which is super cool. How do you in using an off-the-shelf or no-code tool like that, how do you assess the risks that you're assuming by doing that?
So I naturally have to, you know, let you guys know I'm biased. Voiceflow is a no-code or low-code product. So yeah. Always very pro on that. It's also very hot right now. I'm all for empowering people that don't know how to necessarily code. But I think like there's always a risk that comes from any experiment. And I think if you're at a stage or early enough where you're really just trying to validate whether or not someone is going to be able to or be interested in doing an action or be interested in trying out something new, if you can use a no-code solution where you can just get it in the hands of people faster to just test that, to me, that outweighs a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to be said with a grain of salt, because I think in some instances, like for instance, my past job, I worked at a company called Clio, which was in legal tech. I had a lot more constraints and a lot more things that I had to consider when it came to building out things that may not be hosted directly on our own servers or going through a certain level of compliance. So I think it really depends on the type of experiment or what you're trying to test for. But in this case, where people are just sharing their public links and they just want an easy way of just like showcasing what it is that they're working on, to me, like the risk of that is so low. You just want to give them something.
Mm-hmm. So you're obviously very pro no code, as you've said, pro no co. And Airtable, great in this scenario for indexing work and displaying it. What else do you lean on? What other off-the-shelf tools, no-code tools are you leaning on to roll out your experiments quickly?
Yeah, so I think that there's so many like no-code tools that are out there that can really make somebody feel empowered in a role where they don't have too many resources. Mm-hmm. But like even as an example for this marketplace, like we started with it just being hosted on Airtable just for the function of it. And then I was like, I would like this to have transactional emails on top of that and like let people know that it's, for instance, we have to go and approve what goes on there. So there's like a little bit of a lag. So now trying to, you know, build out a more robust experience. So we use Zapier. I think everyone in the no-code space is a fan of Zapier to be able to pull the submissions that we had from Airtable and then put that into Autopilot, which is also a really awesome no-code tool for email management and also no-code email building if you want to do more graphic emails, transactional emails. I even have a bunch of lead scoring or custom scoring that I do in Autopilot as well. And it also lets me push a bunch of different stuff into Segment, which is, I wouldn't say is a no code solution by any means, but mm-hmm. is definitely one that is good and allows people that are using tools like Autopilot or Zapier or other things that rely on events in a product to do a lot of things. But, all of those, and even in combination with Webflow, which we used for our submission page to really have more of a branded experience and actually try to cookie people when they go through this marketplace at this point, all of these tools are awesome ways that we were able to really build what started to look like a much larger, complex product than it being hosted on like four no-code tools.
So do you think as the marketplace continues to evolve and you discover what the needs of it are, do you think you'll continue to iterate on Airtable, or will it be at some point replaced when you do a V2 or a V3?
So I think that the caveat of being in growth and trying to do these, I don't want to say hackier ways of doing things because the term growth hack just like irks me, but but I think the whole point of this V1 in almost any of these growth phases is really just to test what is the initial action that you want someone to take and do they respond to it. And at this point, it's like we've already tested that out. You want to now own that data. You want to now think about what would that look like? Or have you pushed the constraints of the no-code tool to the point where you should move it off to something? So like to answer your question on specifically for the marketplace, like with Airtable, you get the ease of it being able to take submissions, push onto this seemingly like pretty easy to navigate database, especially easy for us to control what views that people that are not at Voiceflow can look at. But we lose that capability of being able to do advanced tracking in some of these things, or even have better branding on stuff so it's more consistent. So definitely plan on moving that to, and we've already done this, moving it off of Airtable and slowly just making it into an actual Voiceflow branded experience.
When you're looking at stuff like this, you know, how much are you looking at what interface design tools are doing really as guidance for how you solve the problem? For example, Figma and Framer, you know, they've got very, very active marketplaces built right into their platform. Are you looking at what the iterations were that got it to its current state on those products to kind of inform how you approach it? Does it help to validate the idea in itself to a certain extent, seeing how much uptake those marketplaces have gotten?
Yeah, I think definitely looking to what other similar toolings in different interfaces have done has been huge for us. Mm-hmm. There's so much that you can learn from the previous interface shift, with that being the GUI space, so graphic user interfaces. And also, like, even going further back, and I think one of the things that's really interesting for voice in this scenario is I spend a lot of my time actually going through more or studying more like behavioral shifts that have come along with interface adoption, and a lot more time even looking at like anthropological changes with how do people communicate, what are habits that are learned versus innate, and how can we mimic some of those experiences with even how we're going to be shaping our marketplace differently. Because if you also think about, for us, there's a lot of other things that we need to consider, given the fact that voice is not a graphic experience. And in a lot of those marketplaces, honestly, all of them, no matter Framer, Sketch, Figma, all of them are graphic in what people are consuming. So we need to also really consider on how do people actually consume what it is that they're searching for as well.
Let's take a brief ad break. This episode of Framework is brought to you by Linode. With Linode, you can deploy a server in the Linode cloud in minutes. They offer cloud computing plans for every workload, from simple web hosting to CPU-intensive needs like video encoding and machine learning. If you're new to Linode, you can claim a $20 credit right now and start building right away. Whether you're working on distributed apps, hosted services, websites, CI environments, and more, there's an instance type for any workload. You can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers, including their newest in Toronto and Mumbai, right now, and you only pay for what you use. They've got hourly billing across all plans and one-price add-on services. Linode's always evolving to serve you better, too. It's already super easy to deploy and maintain your apps and services with their Cloud Manager, API, and CLI. If this sounds like some interesting tech, they're also hiring. You can check out linode.com/careers. To claim your $20 credit, visit linode.com/framework. That's linode.com/framework. And use the promo code framework2019, all one word. That's linode.com/framework with promo code framework2019. And we're back. So when you were setting this up originally, just to sort of go back to the beginning of this marketplace experiment, how much consideration was given to creating this consistent experience across both this experiment that you've built on Airtable and the actual platform?
So I think definitely, like, for the V1, I'm not gonna lie, like, we put it out pretty quickly. It did not look like it was us. It looked very much so like it was Airtable. And it was really just more, we were the ones who introduced it. We were the ones who talked about it. We were the ones who promoted it to our community. I think the absolute most branding that went into it, which will like definitely make a marketer that listens to this squeal, is like putting like a poorly sized version of our logo on the intake form that is natural in Airtable. So that was kind of the first step at it. That lasted for about like a day before that drove me nuts, and I had to go in and make it a little bit better than that. But I think the cool thing about these types of tests versus actually having to really think about a core product push or something that you're actually lining up with your PMM team or any form of actual like full promotion to get people to come on and check it out, is that it doesn't need to be perfect, doesn't need to be brand perfect, pixel perfect in a lot of these cases. You're really just trying to test it out with people who already trust you, who are already your ideal type of customer, if you have that. Some people do that through beta lists. We have our community, which I actually think are actually a core retention lever for us as well. So they're an awesome way for us to be able to kind of get around some of these things. Yeah. And then the more that we started to see traction on it, that's when it became very clear that it lining up with our actual brand and our core experience started to become way more of a focus for us, and has definitely been a huge thing that we've considered with the newer version of the marketplace.
So if there wasn't really that emphasis on trying to get it brand perfect out of the gates there, like, when did you know you were ready to push this out? What was kind of the milestone in pushing release on this?
Yeah, I think the milestone really was is that we were losing so much information in our current way that people were sharing their products. So in the way that if anyone's been in a really active Facebook group before, you know that there's nothing more ephemeral than a comment that is in a Facebook group. Like it is just, it might as well be Snapchat at some points. So we were just losing a lot of that. And there was some quality content that was in there that it's just not easy for people to be able to kind of do that discoverability. And that really brought us back to a core problem that just kept coming up the more that we thought about voice, even as an industry. And that's when we really realized that this was not only a problem for our own community and the things or the ways that our creators were sharing stuff, but also just in a much greater context. It's just hard to find voice apps or voice experiences. And even the actual skill stores or the Google Play Store right now isn't super easy to go in and discover new things that people are doing or even be able to connect with the people that have built those. And that's really the stage that voice is at right now. So it became pretty abundantly clear that we should just have something, some way of categorizing it.
So it was just get something built and out the door as quick as possible. Like that was the kind of decision of when this thing was ready to go, or?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of us just like, you know, false urgency in startups where you just want to be the first to everything. But also the fact that we just saw more and more comments that were coming up inside our group where people were sharing and they would very quickly get lost. So we just wanted to focus that and also like create this resource that becomes a lot more accessible for people when they want to specifically find that type of content. Yeah. And I think a core thing about just maintaining community as well is really being able to protect what it is that people are sharing and where can they access the right information.
Yeah. This feels like it was in response to an opportunity that you identified and decided that you really need to fill that gap. Is that normally the way that you roll out these kind of these experiments, or is there a cadence that you'd normally be following or a roadmap for the kind of growth focused experiments that you'd normally run?
So I think like every single company and every quarter is so different based on what your top priorities are. And I think like in the past, I've definitely prioritized things that have been more on lead generation. So let's say like our normal ways of signups or our early adopters have been like dried up at this point. And now we're trying to go after people who are more stubborn. So we have to focus or we have to get experiments out the door that help make that transition easier. So eliminate the barrier of education and mastery, so it becomes easier for them to understand. So that's like one way of thinking about it. This way was really more, we are starting to see like this exponential difference or this gap that's happening in people who spend more time actually working through these problems and even creating anything from like a really simple voice app to being able to connect their voice app to an API and make like their own version of Google Maps. And we want to be able to have a way for that people can actually show what are some of those works so that we can actually have that in one spot. So that one was really more on the problem we were trying to solve, was just making our experience, which is already in a space that's so new, feel less alone and feel more focused on this collaborative community that we see in Facebook, but make it accessible to people outside as well.
So it sounds like there are some that some experiments are a bit more intentional to try and ladder back to company priorities. Others are more like this or more opportunistic. How do you measure, how do you set measures for success on these more ad hoc opportunistic experiments that you run?
Yeah. So I think in a lot of cases, like, you're always still driving it back to a core business metric in some ways. This one to me was opportunity for lead generation to get people to actually know about us if they're just searching around in voice in general, but also for activation. So maybe people can actually see stuff that's in there and they'd be like, oh, I actually want to replicate that. And I know I've done that as like a designer in a previous life where I would go and dribble and be like, I'm going to make exactly that. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe we can see that. And in other ways as well is like, can we turn casual to power users where now they've seen, they've done multiple projects, they're posting, and we're giving them an opportunity to do that. And even in the future, and this is kind of further in the roadmap, is when you get to a critical mass of this type of sharing and this type of environment that a marketplace does, is can we now use that for like predicting product roadmap? Or maybe we can even do a way that we can actually create like the Upwork of a voice in the future where people can see their showcase and maybe get hired. So there's like a lot of ways that we could tie something that seems seemingly ad hoc to still core business metrics. And every experiment, don't get me wrong, still tends to go back to a business metric.
It's a great point you touched on earlier where it was just like going and aping things off Dribbble. Like that's actually some of, you know, in my experience working with designers, like some of the best learning you can do is just kind of going and deconstructing how did somebody get to this output. Mm-hmm. You know, if that helps, if this is a mechanism with which more people can understand how to build voice apps and you know, better their own craft, that's a pretty great value add for the community.
Yeah. And like what's interesting about these things, and even while I'm saying like these are like the marketplace itself and most of these experiments are really to help move a business metric, is like we still don't know in the future if maybe this marketplace will work better if it's not VoiceFlow branded. Maybe it's just something that we do just to inspire and expand what the user base for voice is.
Yeah.
Or maybe it is something that is integral, or maybe we even split it up. So we have like a showcase version that's more like Dribbble for voice and one that's more like plugins, one that's more like templates specifically for VoiceFlow. So there's so many ways that we can go from this moving forward.
So you talked about a few ways that you could potentially segment out the content that you're accruing in this marketplace. Obviously, because it is so heavily leaning on user-generated content, how do you measure or ensure or try to otherwise qualify that content that's coming in? How do you deal with sort of those different levels that you mentioned? Like, you know, one person is just making something fun to learn and another person is like going really deep on an API.
Yeah, I think the short answer is manually. Yeah.
Sounds exhausting.
That's the truth. It's this wonderful Wizard of Oz situation.
Yeah.
You say that now, but like you also, you know, it's a learning experience. You gotta go through the mud every now and again before you figure out what it is that you're doing. Like first steps, it's manual. Oftentimes you can fake something that looks automated as a manual thing. You need what, 2 days to go in and actually like play around with the stuff that comes through, like maybe tag it if you need to, send them an automated email to say that we're reviewing your skill before it goes live. Like, that's fine. You've set the precedent for that. Like, that's okay. Then there's other scenarios where in the future we'll probably like start to figure out what are some of those tags. Do we want like VoiceFlow, I don't know, approved ones that are maybe like more of those template style ones that we highlight, or do we want to make it easier for people to just maybe even search them off by like how long did it take to build this thing? Because like that's the data that people might want to know, like how fast can they do that? So these are all tests that we can do that are small iterative things for later.
And so when you're looking at those kind of future iterations, how are you justifying sinking additional time resources into an experiment to kind of take it to the next version? Like, is there a scenario where the Airtable version would just be done? Like, that would be the final state?
I think in some cases, like, yeah, I think there's definitely some times where you're like, you know what, like, this doesn't actually have a greater purpose outside of our core user group. Maybe this is just a way for, like a good example of that being is, let's say if people were just like sharing their concerns more, we wouldn't necessarily want to make that into like, oh, this is a totally separate platform that will make it easy for people to go in, log in and log their concerns, which now me saying that out loud sounds like Zendesk. So sorry about that. Maybe there's value in that. My bad. But with our specific community, it might just be we create a form and that way it's just easy to generate like tickets for us, right? Mm-hmm. With this type of experiment and most growth experiments is I like to kind of compare them to like the kid that's proving themselves versus like the sibling that like got everything handed to them. you're continuously going through steps where it's trying to prove its worth and keep proving that to continuously justify getting more resources. It's not easy, but eventually you'll reach a point where the value is very clear. And much like what you need to make a good product assessment and actually get a product on the roadmap is you need that same type of validation. You need that same type of intention. And most of these experiments start with a lower barrier for that. So in a lot of ways, you're just trying to get it to that point where it seems so core that it's no longer a question.
Growth's the forgotten middle child of the product startup.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lonely place to be.
We're both important. We're both part of the family.
So just extrapolating forward a bit, do you think product and growth people like ourselves will need to really have a greater understanding of where we can deploy these kind of no-code tools and no-code solutions regularly in our product development cycles?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in a lot of ways, the way that product development and growth experimentation is really shifting is, and where I've definitely seen in some of like the better, more cohesive teams that have both product and growth is that they have such a balance of people who are really good at breaking down these large problems into really, you know, digestible chunks, but also balance execution more so than just trying to delegate. And that's kind of a really core thing that I think no code solutions and being able to have a tool belt of that is so powerful is because in a lot of these cases, you shouldn't be limited to having to write out a ticket and get it like absolutely perfect in order to get something out. Because in a lot of these cases for experimentation specifically, like it's not perfect. You don't know what the end thing is and it's going to change. So if you set that same process, it's just going to lead to the person who's actually doing the work at the end, if you aren't also helping in execution, get deeply frustrated with you. And also have like this lack of understanding on where it's going. So I think it's super important to be able to understand these tools and understand what you as a growth manager or product manager can do before you make that ask or involve people earlier on in that strategy so that maybe you can even challenge, let's say, an engineer to become more of like a growth engineer, where they also play that role where they can interject and say that, oh, maybe we can change this flow a little bit differently because it'll be easier to iterate on in the future.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to kind of share responsibility or share opportunity to actually like deliver value. I know, like, you know, as a product manager, you're typically not, you're never shipping anything. Your product is kind of the result of the team's effort, but some of this tooling enables more of that, where you can actually have like deliver functionality that directly gets in the hands of your customer. So there's just kind of more of an opportunity to spread the work around on teams this way.
Yeah. And I think like one of the things that I really love about seeing how like product growth teams or growth and product teams kind of work together is they're often a group of people that have totally different perspectives or like their own personal tool belt. Mm-hmm. So often you'll have like a designer, a developer, an analyst, a marketer, a marketer and a PM, or some variants of those types of perspectives, all working towards one goal. Where instead of you thinking about it as, okay, we need to get this to a certain point, then pass it off to marketing, then pass it off to sales, or pass it off to a different role, is oftentimes, like, you see a lot more of this collaboration that happens. So you spend less time in these tickets, you spend less time in the documentation, more time in just understanding, okay, what is what we're testing? What's everyone's role in that? Okay, let's reconvene in the next 2 days to see, did that work? Did that not? And keep falling in that cycle.
And I guess that's probably leads into the last question we really have for you, which is, like, is that the model that you think is going to become the pervasive one for growth and product teams moving forward? That there is going to be this blending of functions and kind of further blurring of the lines between the two functions that are currently fairly separate in most product companies?
Yeah, I think in the future, where I really do see things is, like, and this is like a weird perspective to come from someone who has been in growth in this whole, for most of her career, is that I genuinely believe that growth teams shouldn't have to exist.
Yeah.
I think that it should be a shared responsibility in the same way that people know that every department contributes to growth in some way. I think that growth and product as separate functions can work so long as they're aligned in what it is that they're working on and share what it is that is coming out and how they can play off each other. Because really where I think growth becomes the strongest is when you're really trying to drive the most people, the most activation, the most engagement on the things that product is shipping. Mm-hmm. And that's extremely important that those two parts play really well together. And it's not just the same as understanding the messaging on what's going out there or who are you targeting for it, but it's really trying to figure out how do you guys work off each other so that product really makes sure that the product works and growth makes sure that the right aspects of whatever feature that was just built are the ones that are being highlighted and, you know, continuing that type of relationship. And I think for a lot of different companies who are becoming more and more product led, you'll see a lot more of this blurring.
Yeah.
And a lot more of product managers who care deeply about the engagement and the metrics that come back on how many people are actually using what they've built, and more growth people having a larger stake in the conversation that comes with the product roadmap.
Awesome. Well, that's a great point to wrap this up on. Thank you so much, Emily, for joining us to talk about all this today.
Cool. Thanks so much for having me.
And a big thank you to our listeners for listening. If you're interested in learning more about VoiceFlow, you can check it out at voiceflow.com.
Framework is part of the Spec Network. That's a podcast network built to help designers and developers level up. You can find more shows like Framework over at spec.fm. And thanks to Drew Looper, who edits and helps to produce this show.
If you enjoyed this episode of Framework, help more listeners find the show by leaving a review or rating on iTunes, or recommend the podcast to your friends. If you'd like to hear someone else's product story on Framework or to tell your own, we'd love to hear from you. And our contact details and Twitter handles are on our website, framework.is. See you next time.